Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Hello there and welcome to Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University, which comes out each week. I'm joined, as usual, by Maria Tafalaga, Dr. Maria Tafalaga, I should say, from the School of Politics and International Relations here at ANU, with which I'm also associated. Hi there, Maria.
Hello. How are you?
I'm going very well. And you?
Wonderful.
That's good. That's good. It's an interesting time in politics at the moment because apart from the fact that Canberra's fired back up again after the midwinter break, we've got Scott Morrison back in the news saying he really had nothing to do with robo-debt and that it's a political lynch mob that's been after him. And we've got, the issues being referred to the NAC, the National Anti-Corruption Commission, and an argument or debate about what's appropriate there, what level of workload should be going to that organisation, with Albanese, the Prime Minister, saying yesterday in Parliament that that he doesn't think things should automatically be referred to the NAC, that ought not just become part of the normal sort of discourse of debate when issues arise in politics. I think he's probably right on that, incidentally. Just sort of assuming that everything is worthy of going to the NAC and using the actual charge itself as part of the political armory in debates around issues that arise. I think
that's absolutely wise, yes. Yes. Otherwise, it is at risk of politicisation.
Yeah, that's right. So apart from the fact that the organisation itself would become quickly overwhelmed, given that politics is a sort of a competitive and combative business, adversarial in nature, that's the way it's set up. So the idea that every time you've got a disagreement with someone, or in most cases where you've got a disagreement with someone and there's claims of things being done that are not straightforward, that someone's going to say, well, this should be referred to the NAC, and that probably undervalues what the NAC is there for. And ideally, it shouldn't be public recommendations that are going to that organisation anyway. It should be the organisation itself, the commission, undertaking work that it has either been referred to it by whistleblowers or that it has undertaken of its own volition as a result of things that are happening in the public sphere, or that it's able to that it's been made aware of. So, yeah, quite interesting.
I mean, I think the logic does suggest, though, that there will be more referrals in the first few years of the NAC's life than later. I mean, if it is actually an effective body, and it's clearly been created because there is a perception, some of which is reflected in Australia's corruption rankings, global corruption rankings.
Yes.
So in some senses, it doesn't surprise me that there is this, I suppose, sort of surge, because there is a lot of questions out there about several sort of programs or things that have sort of gone on in recent years. But we can only kind of hope that the NAC becomes a little bit more, a less used body.
Yes.
in years to come, because it's actually done its job and changed behaviour.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Really, the best thing you can say about it, apart from cleaning up things that have already happened, if it worked at its absolute optimum, and this is obviously a kind of a theoretical idea rather than an actual likelihood, but if it worked at its absolute best, the very existence of the NAC would be a kind of have a sobering effect on those who were thinking about breaking the rules, and they might not do it. So it's not just about the investigations that it undertakes in respect of things that have already happened. It's perhaps its greatest value is in helping to clean up politics and rebuild trust between voters and or between citizens and public administration, that things are being done correctly and that there is a body there to ensure that if they're not being, if there is dishonesty and skullduggery and so forth going on, that there is a mechanism there which will find out about that and people will pay a price. And hopefully we get better public administration out of that. It's not a bad thing.
Not at all. Long overdue.
Indeed. The aforementioned robo-debt is one of those things that perhaps there may be further referrals in relation to that. And of course, we've seen the recent PwC controversy in relation to decisions that were made there, information that was used for commercial gain and the like. And perhaps there are other cases. We know there have been so many cases referred, so many complaints referred to the NAC, and not all of those will end up being investigations, but many of them will, and that is a good thing. So I think even if we do get this better level of public administration, we're going to have to go through a period where the commission is undertaking work which results in some fairly uncomfortable revelations.
And it's a sort of similar kind of dynamic that this is a point we've made in the past, right? Like there's a similar dynamic that underwent in the sort of 70s in which we sort of had this rash of royal commissions because many of the sort of institutional settings that have been put in place at a policy level were no longer seen to sort of function and they required national attention. We've had a decade of royal commissions now kind of pointing at that. But what we haven't really had is, I suppose, some institutional responses to be able to respond to certain dimensions of problems with public governance. And I think it is alarming that we sort of like there's this latest story about the issuing of contracts to from the Immigration or Home Affairs Department as a result of a special investigation in the Nine papers around
offshore detention.
Yeah, in places like Nauru. I think some of the narrative around corruption and why the Commonwealth Integrity Commission, as it was at the time, was resisted was because there was this sort of narrative of a few bad apples. But actually, what we're actually seeing is a picture here of systemic failures in our public systems of management and government. But on the flip side, like the fact that we're even finding out about them suggests that there are correctives, right? That, you know, the institutions are capable of self-correcting to some degree and that other institutions that are there to monitor and observe these things, Parliament for one, the media for another, you know, they actually are doing their job. So even though you might dislike the media, you might find Parliament, you know, useless, like you can only imagine what the place would be like without them.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it's actually important to remember.
Yeah, I think that's right. And a lot of people who attack the mainstream media, as they call it, the MSM, forget that a good many of these things come about because mainstream media organisations have the resources and the investment size and commitment to pursue some of these stories. And if we think of the Ben Robert Smith revelations and all of those revelations associated with behaviour of troops overseas, a lot of these things came about because of investigative journalism, or were certainly taken advanced considerably as a result of the investment that really only media organisations with a degree of scale and commercial heft are able to pursue. The other thing I'd say, Maria, just in relation to the point you were making about what we understand as a result of all of these revelations about the level of corruption is that it wasn't that long ago, and people should remember this, it wasn't that long ago that neither side of politics, of the major parties, was in favour of an anti-corruption commission at the federal level. And the argument that was put, and I heard people say this, was that there were anti-corruption commissions at the state level, and there wasn't really any evidence of any federal corruption. At the national level, there wasn't any sort of malfeasance or
self-serving.
Yeah, and I suspect it was probably said by some people with a degree of naivety, you know, that they actually believed it. But it was one of those problems where, yeah, you don't see it because you're not looking. These things aren't coming to light. It doesn't mean they aren't there. And the flood of complaints or referrals that have been made to the new Anti-Corruption Commission suggests that there's a bit of pent-up demand there, as you were saying, and we'll see where that goes. It is not, however, what we are talking about today. We're going to talk about climate today, and I guess allied to that, climate change and climate change politics and the science and so forth. And I'm really glad to have with us in the studio Professor Jeanette Lindsay. She's from the Fenner School of Environment and Society here at ANU in the College of Science. Welcome, Jeanette.
Hi, it's nice to be with you.
It's terrific to have you. It's been too long. We should have done this a long time ago because this issue of climate change, of course, has been going on for a long time, but it feels really pertinent right at the moment. Because we've got this, as we've seen, anyone who's been watching the news can see it, you know, we've had this heat wave going on in the Northern Hemisphere, which has had all kinds of catastrophic effects.
Indeed.
And I think it's really kind of brought home to a lot of people that really what had been being said for a long time, that we were going to start to see these things, and we're starting to see them, we're starting to live them, and they're very, very uncomfortable, and they're lethal in some cases.
Indeed.
What's actually going on? I mean, can we just go to basics here? How does this heat wave, which is mostly in the Northern Hemisphere, come about?
Well, it comes about because, in fact, the globe has been heating for decades on decades. We've been putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which trap heat that would otherwise have just exited out of the top of the atmosphere and gone off to space. That's the process that generally keeps the planet in a sort of temperature equilibrium, if you like. And that has been disrupted by human activity since the Industrial Revolution and the consumption of and burning of fossil fuels and so on. And land clearing is the other big one, which often doesn't get a mention. But it is huge because by converting natural ecosystems into agricultural land or urban spaces or for infrastructure or whatever we do, what we're doing is removing possible absorption areas for carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and all sorts of other processes that help to regulate the planetary atmosphere and keep things pretty comfortable. Plants take up carbon dioxide and they give off oxygen, for example.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is all part of an overall system and we really have to look at it as a whole system to understand what's going on. So by disrupting the Earth's natural cycles, more and more of us doing so over time, we're now plus 8 billion on the planet, we've effectively altered our environment in a way that is extremely detrimental to us. And the way that it's sometimes referred to is to consider it as an unplanned experiment. Now, if you're doing really good experimental science, what you do is you have a control. Mm. So you have a system set up which mirrors reality, and then you have another system which is controlled in order to mimic the change that you're trying to model.
Yeah, so it's identical in every way except for the change you're making. Yeah.
Now, of course, the system we're messing with is Planet A, our home, Earth, and we don't have Planet B as our control. Mm. So we are living through and experiencing the impacts of the changes that have been made to this system. And in many ways, they've been made quite willfully because it's not as if we haven't known for a very long time that by putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, it would raise the temperature.
But when you say we haven't known, I mean, it's an interesting concept that, the we, right? Because it hasn't been completely accepted by all,
even though
that's becoming the naysayers of this against this, you know, the people who ignore the science and all of the evidence and have done so willfully and politically for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is they are in recession, if I can put it like that. They are
Let's hope so.
In retreat would be a better way of putting it, some degree of retreat.
Yeah.
And I even read a conservative commentator yesterday complaining about the impact that it's having on the economies in the Northern Hemisphere, and the way the economies of the Northern Hemisphere, particularly the tourist economies of the Northern Hemisphere, are being dramatically affected, and a lot of their long-term assumptions about expenditure, the investments they've made and so forth, everything from airlines to hotels and resorts and countries that have, you know, their economies built at least to a large extent on summer tourism in Europe in particular, having to rethink this, because a lot of these places, and we've seen these, you know, the Greek islands, you know, beautiful historic Greek islands that we've known about for years, and which are now facing dramatic, the possibility of dramatic change. They have vegetation that, unlike Australia, is not designed to burn.
Yes, exactly.
And it is burning.
Mm-hmm. And you know, when I say we have known for a long time, the scientific community has known for a long time. And in fact, you know, the earliest documented experimentation that was done to show what the impact of carbon dioxide could be if released in sufficient quantities into the atmosphere, and that it would result in warming of the planet, was done in the late 1800s. So, you know, we're talking about more than a century ago that science was out there, and it was reasonably well known in the scientific community, but it didn't become sort of common, I suppose you could say, or a real focus of scientific concern until probably 1950s, 60s. There was a bit of a focus. And then once we hit the 1980s and into the 90s, that's when it really started to take off and get a great deal of attention. And that was because of the work of quite a large number of key scientists who worked very hard to get this onto the agenda and to get it being discussed in a general population context, if you like, so that it was part of the community conversation. And the Rio Earth Summit in 1991, that was very instrumental in getting this off the ground, because that was a conference, a meeting of all countries with representation. We went off to Rio and had this big meeting. There'd been a lot of work done in the lead up to that for years, actually, to put together all the science around global heating and climate change and the impact on ecological systems and human systems and everything else, in order to have that as a very informed forum. And out of that came the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Kyoto Protocol, and then much later, 2015, the Paris Agreement, and these sort of terms, the Copenhagen Accords and so on and so on, which we've sort of heard bandied around, and they get reported as they happen, and there's a bit of attention on them, and then they sort of recede into the background from the general consciousness, I think. But they are there underpinning global action and national action on addressing the reasons for what's going on.
That's the tension, though, isn't it? Global action and national action. It almost frames the problem.
It really does.
Global problem. We have the requirement for national action.
Yes.
We might be in now what you might call the Urgentine period, which is the period where even the most recalcitrant and blind of people, or willfully blind, that is, of people in relation to this cannot deny it. And we're getting this sort of galloping effect. But it's the story you just laid out, and I'm really grateful that you did, because it explains just how long this has been. There's been a scientific consensus about it, and the evidence, of course, has just been building up more and more all the time. But there's a real mismatch between, as I say, between nation states and their sort of political economic interests and the global problem. And also there's a mismatch, I suppose, between the science and the politics, which is to say climate change fell into the kind of the sort of taxonomic grid of politics, you know, the binary of left-right, which has been really quite damaging for it. There's no actual logical reason why being concerned about the environment is a left-wing preoccupation, but that's the way it's tended to fall. And as a result, people on the right in many cases have sort of tribally taken an antithetic position on it.
That's true. And I think you see this playing out in many places around the world. It's You see it in America, you know, where the left-right divide, I think, is particularly stark.
Yeah.
And you see the opposite, or have seen the opposite. It's less true just at the minute, I think, in UK politics, where a consensus was reached years ago politically that climate change, or global heating, as I actually prefer to refer to it,
yes.
Was to be treated in a bipartisan way. And it was too important to allow it to become a point of political differentiation. And as a result of that, we saw the UK enact various forms of legislation around sort of very practical things like energy efficiency in buildings and, you know, building codes that made homes and business premises and so on more energy efficient, therefore using less power and therefore requiring less power generation, and thereby assisting the transition to more renewable forms of energy, because there was lessening the demand, if you like, on the fossil fuel driven energy production. So that's just one example. So there's a lot of evidence that bipartisan support for action on reducing emissions, for mitigation of climate change, is very effective. And by the way, that's a term that often gets misunderstood, mitigation.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed that there's quite a lot of discourse around the term mitigation, where it's assumed that what you're talking about is reducing the impacts of the fact that the planet is warming, mitigating the impacts. Whereas in fact, when scientists talk about it, we're talking about mitigating the emissions, reducing the emissions that cause the warming in the first place.
Right.
And so that's something just that I think it's an example of how there can be very legitimate misunderstandings between the scientific community and the general public, the social discourse around topics like this, which, if left uncorrected, I think just persist and perhaps lead to a degree of obfuscation, maybe, which is unintended on both sides.
I have an unfair question.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, like, you know, your point about language, you know, I think is actually a really interesting one. You know, I mean, scientists communicate in a very different way to the average citizen, right? They talk in the language of theories, of probabilities, of likelihoods, of odds ratios. Do you think that is actually, you know, you gave the example of mitigation here, where like two different people hear a different kind of word, but I mean, do you think that is actually one of the reasons why we've sort of struggled to make progress on this issue beyond the obvious culprit, which is political actors not doing enough?
Sure. Ooh, I think you're quite right that there's a scientific language and an understanding that underpins that language and use of terminology, which is not necessarily shared across all of society. And I think a lot of scientists in all sorts of fields, and I'm not just talking here about environmental scientists or climate scientists, have worked hard to find ways to communicate which are scientifically meaningful and rigorous, but still convey the meaning in ways that people without that background and training can better understand. And I mean, I think it's true that not all people are the best communicators. And I think everybody knows that. Some people are better at it than others. And I think there are some in the scientific community who perhaps find it more difficult than others to remove themselves a little bit from the rigorous language and expression that is trained into us as we develop our scientific careers. And it's perfectly understandable that would be the case. And I think one of the key concepts here, which has been difficult in the context of climate change and global heating, is that of uncertainty. And it's often a bit of a stumbling block for people to understand what scientists mean when they talk about a particular phenomenon. You know, in this case, let's say the amount of carbon dioxide that needs to be in the atmosphere, or other greenhouse gases that need to be there in order to have the planet reach 2 degrees of global heating. Okay. Now, there's uncertainty around that. And what I mean when I say that is that the number, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere that would get us to that point, it could be you know, 50 parts per million one way or 50 parts per million the other way. It doesn't mean we don't understand the science and that we don't understand the process. It simply means that we cannot, with absolute accuracy to 10 decimal places, say exactly how many parts per million. Because this is an extremely complex system.
It's the difference between a forecast and a prediction.
It is. Like, well, yes, indeed. Or a scenario, you know. We work a lot with scenarios in the field of climate change and global heating, where we're projecting into the future based on where we are now, what has happened in the past, the trajectory that has led us to where we are, and where we project things are likely to go if certain decisions are made and various consequences flow from those decisions. And those could be decisions about cutting emissions and going fully renewable. It could be decisions around political choices. It could be decisions around economic choices that are made by nation states or by companies even. You know, we're living in the age now where individual companies, as we well know, often have revenues that exceed national budgets and are in a position to make decisions which can have a material impact on a phenomenon like global heating.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take a very short break and be back in a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Now, we were talking just before the break about, I guess, uncertainty and the inevitable nature of uncertainty being a factor in projections, particularly when they're based on evidence. And that evidence is building up all the time, of course, and that makes the models more sophisticated and more accurate, and there's a process going on. But the politics, you know, the people who have been opposed to this have weaponized this bit in the, you know, this 2% or whatever it might have been at any given time. Because what they've been in the game of doing is manufacturing doubt, of leveraging doubt. There's not an absolute consensus on this. Here's a scientist who disagrees. They can't tell you for certain that this outcome will occur at this date on account of this amount of carbon or whatever it might be, as you were just saying. And that, in a political sense, has been absolutely kind of crucial for them. I mean, it's been really sort of leveraged up and in a paralyzing way. I mean, I think what I've seen in this country, and I think it's been the case in other democracies, you mentioned the US in particular, perhaps a bit less so in some of the European democracies, but this doubt question has become political fodder, and it has led to a paralysis, a go slow, and an inability really to take decisions. Think about where we would be. I was thinking about this the other day, actually, when I was looking at Australia's policy, the sort of debates we're having at the moment, looking at the Northern Hemisphere, which we'll come to again in a sec. But, you know, the where we would be had we actually done what we set out to do in 2007 and established an emissions trading scheme and made the kinds, put the market signals in to preference investment in renewable energy and so forth, and really changed this economy, where we would be sitting now compared to where we are. We just lost a lot of time, and lots of governments have. And that's because the politics and the science has been kind of almost working, they've been working in opposition to each other.
Yes, absolutely. And I agree with you completely. And I think for me, it's saying that it's the politics, it's also the vested interests that are influencing the politics. And in a way, it's almost more those vested interests, because if you think about...
Are you talking about like the oil and gas industry, for example?
Yes, I am. So, you know, when you think about what those industries and the people involved in them and financing them and benefiting from them stand to lose potentially, and not potentially, actually, by defossil fuelization, if I can coin a term, of energy production, that's the reason they exist. That's where all their money comes from. And unless they are able to completely recast themselves as renewable energy generators, say, or in some other way move on from the fossil fuel era, there's a great deal to be lost there. And I think the vested interests of that are wrapped up in what really seems to drive everything, which is power and money, in those contexts of primary production and the fossil fuel industry in particular, have had an enormous influence. And it's come to light that there has been huge investment from that quarter into denialism campaigns and in influencing politicians and that sort of thing, in order to keep those sectors going as long as they possibly can, knowing full well that eventually they're going to have to stop.
Yeah.
Because if we are not to have runaway global heating and the worst consequences of the trajectory we're currently on in the future, we have to leave at least some of that fossil fuel in the ground. And in fact, we have to stop now.
Yeah.
We've run out of time.
But it's not just us burning coal here, is it? I mean, it's us digging it up and selling it, exporting huge quantities of it to economies that are using it in great amounts, to power their electricity grids and so forth. And it's economic for them to do it that way. So we're part of a global problem in that sense,
as
well as the global heating problem.
Yes.
We're part of the causation problem, and our economy is built to a large extent on that.
Yes, it is.
It's hard to turn that ship around.
It is very hard to turn that ship around.
Especially when you've got people in politics finding ways to maximise the advantage they can get from resisting.
Mm.
And we've seen, Tony Abbott was elected in 2013.
Yep.
On scrapping the carbon price.
Yes.
That was it, That was the
absolutely
the big thing, really. That was the decision the Australian voters made too, by the way.
I think the Australian voters were very comprehensively misinformed about what the carbon price actually was and the impact it would have. And that's been another powerful weapon that's been used, I think, by the denialist sector, if you can call it that, in that they've been able to use language, going back to Maria's point about language, they've been able to use key words very effectively to scare people. Effectively, these have been scare tactics.
But people are now getting scared by what's actually happening. So let's go that's here and now, though. And it's when climate change starts, global heating, to use the term you prefer, and I prefer too, actually. Mm. When that starts to become here and now, mm-hmm. then denial becomes, even more foolhardy.
Absolutely.
And we're seeing that now, of course. Mm-hmm. What is actually happening, though? We've seen two of the hottest, I think, I think July was the hottest month.
It was.
On record.
And June had been the hottest month on record.
And a couple of dates in July were the hottest day on record. Yes. I don't know if there was a third, but certainly there was a couple there, yeah. Mm. What's actually happening?
What's actually happening? Yeah. So what's been going on? As I said earlier, is we've been continually basically putting the products of fossil fuel combustion into the atmosphere, mm-hmm. and of land clearing. The greenhouse gases that go into the atmosphere are often referred to in a sort of consolidated way under the heading of CO2.
Yeah.
But it also includes methane and nitrous oxide and various other gases.
And some of those are vastly more.
Oh, much more powerful as warming agents in trapping outgoing
methane
heat.
Methane in particular.
Yes, it is. And that's another worry, because melting permafrost in the Northern Hemisphere, for example, is releasing quite large amounts of methane, because rotting vegetation, which has been trapped in the ice and is now being freed up to go off into the atmosphere, is contributing. Anyway, but so there's more and more of this greenhouse gas being emitted, and there's less of a capacity of the Earth system to absorb it. So what's been happening is that natural processes, which involve CO2 in particular, being absorbed by vegetation and being absorbed into the ocean, have been basically getting us out of even more trouble, if you like, for a long time. So about roughly, very roughly, 25% of the emissions that we make on an annual basis have been absorbed into the soil and the vegetation, and another 25% into the ocean. Those are rough figures, but it gives you a rough idea. So it's only about half that ends up in the atmosphere. Now, the worry is that as we reduce vegetation cover, and that's going on everywhere all the time because of the growing population, we need to feed everybody, we need to house everybody, you know, so basically we spread out.
And plus we take cheap options, right?
Oh, of course cheap options. And, you know, everybody wants McDonald's, isn't that right? Mm. So you clear the Amazon for rainforest in order to have beef cattle farming to supply that demand elsewhere. North America and Europe and Australia as well. So there's, you know, there's that sort of tension going on. But this, so the emissions increase, and they don't just go into the air and disappear the same year. They accumulate. So there's a half-life, if you like, for all of these greenhouse gases of differing lengths. CO2 will persist in the atmosphere for at least 100 years, if not longer. Some of the other gases less, some more. They all contribute to the global heating phenomenon that we see. What it means is that they've just been accumulating over time. The net effect has been accumulation. Heat has been trapped in the atmosphere. And that heat has, some of it, gone into the ocean. And when I say some, it's about 90%. So what we are seeing as elevated air temperatures, which heat us up and make us uncomfortable and aware that something's happening, actually it would have been a lot worse if we didn't have 75% of the planet covered by ocean, which has been absorbing a large part of that heat, the vast majority of it. The fact that the ocean is warming is extremely important because it absorbs not only at the surface like the land surface does, very, very superficial. You know, if you're on a hot beach and you dig a little hole, it's much cooler underneath.
Yeah,
I think most people have had that experience. But with the ocean, the surface layer of the water heats up. The water moves around, ocean currents, the wind blows over it. It's dynamic. The heat is transferred downwards. Expeditions have now measured heating of the ocean down below 3,000 meters. The average depth of the ocean is 4,000 meters. So this extra heat from the atmosphere has been, and directly into the ocean from the sun impacting on the ocean, etc., has been transferred downwards almost to the bottom of the ocean by now because it's been going on long enough to do so. That means that there's a huge source of excess heat in the Earth system that is available long after we turn off the fossil fuel emissions and deal with devegetation of the land surface.
And this heat of the land surface and of the ocean then affects the atmosphere.
And that goes back to the atmosphere, you see. And so what we've seen in the Northern Hemisphere this summer is an extremely warm North Atlantic. The Gulf Stream is way above average temperature off the North American East Coast. So the northern coast of the US and the coast of Canada, the East Coast of Canada, that then takes warmer water across the North Atlantic. And that's always, it's been there for a very long time.
That's essentially what stops Britain, England from being colder than it is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It is. Absolutely. And it's why in areas of England, such as Cornwall, you've got the most beautiful gardens in some places which have plants growing, which you would never expect to be growing at those latitudes in the Northern Hemisphere. But they can grow there because the Gulf Stream is keeping it warmer. So there's all of that. Which it's a good thing, not a bad thing. But it's extra hot at the moment. The whole Caribbean, where that ocean system actually originates in the tropics, is warmer than usual. That's being carried across the Northern Hemisphere towards Europe. The Mediterranean has been extremely warm. So I think I saw some figures of sort of 4 to 5 degrees above average for this time of the year in summer, which, when it's warm enough.
Yeah.
And so that has provided an extra heat source. Plus, to the south of Europe, still in the Northern Hemisphere, you've got North Africa. And you've got the Sahara Desert sitting there, and that is absorbing very large amounts of heat at the surface, which then contributes to the formation of a big high-pressure system there that pushes hot air towards Europe, in the normal run of atmospheric circulation.
That's right, and you get the blocking of what would be low-pressure systems that might come through as a result of these enormous high-pressure systems, and as a result, you get this kind of almost a compounding effect.
Yes, you do. And what's happening as the globe is heating is that weather systems are, of course, responding to that. They are driven by heat causing pressure differences across the globe, lower and higher. The wind then blows from low to high pressure and so on. Mm. So essentially, weather systems exist to transfer heat from the Earth's surface upwards and then move it around. Mm. And that's exactly what they're doing. But because it's getting hotter, and because the heating at the surface is not uniform everywhere, it's causing there to be in some areas of the world what we call higher overturning. And that means that the rising of air in the tropics and then the descent in the subtropical location, such as the Sahara, is intensifying. Now, we have the same thing in Australia. So we have rising air into the north of us, and it descends into the high-pressure systems in the Australian region and around the southern hemisphere. And that is intensifying, which is making the high pressures higher, which further limits the penetration of low-pressure systems that might bring rainfall and a bit of relief. And it's causing them to shift, in our case, southward, and push the cold fronts away a little bit. It's what's happening right now in our Australian winter, why it's so warm at the minute. And it's also what has been happening in the Northern Hemisphere with the situation in Europe, in North America, and in China, for example, where they've had extreme heat and now flooding.
Yes, I saw 52 degrees in one place, 52.2 or something.
That's right, new record for China. Now, you know, high temperatures are concerning in their own right because they have an impact on everything that lives, basically. So humans can exist comfortably in temperatures up to about 36 to 38 degrees. And then beyond that, unless we take extra precautions, our core body temperature starts to become compromised and you can become heat stressed, and heat stress can be lethal. Mm. So
yeah, we often hear this said that more people die from severe heat than severe cold.
Absolutely, that is true. And the heat stress as a cause of death is, as recognized by the World Health Organization, as being now an increasing cause of death around the world and a weather-related cause of mortality. And that's a real issue. And it's not just that. There's also lost productivity, for example. So, you know, there's been all sorts of studies done which show that in higher and higher temperatures, especially when humidity is also involved, which it is in some instances, what the productivity of human labor reduces. So we become less productive when we're too hot. And we should, because it's our body telling us that we have to slow down, not move around so quickly, do less, get in the shade, drink lots of water, rest, and stay cool. Otherwise, our core body temperature can rise, and that's an existential threat.
So, Jeanette, I mean, is this reversible, or are we sort of locked into this now, and it's about mitigating anything worse?
On a time scale of a human lifespan, this is not reversible. On the time scale of several thousands of years, probably yes. The longer we let it keep going, the more it will intensify. And the way the system works is that what we do today locks in the future for about 30 years. That's how the natural systems process the changes we're making to the environment, okay, at the rate we're currently making them and to the extent that we are. So we are already locked in to what is going to happen in about 30 years' time. Our vision of what that might look like and how soon we might see some of the more extreme responses of the Earth system to this disruption is not perfect. Climate scientists like myself and the ecologists that we work with and so on had foreseen these sorts of consequences, like we've been seeing in the Northern Hemisphere this summer, as coming down the track. and we've been warning about it for some time. What we hadn't foreseen on the whole was how soon it would happen. These are the sorts of consequences that we had thought would be more likely by about 2050.
And is that because the baseline temperature increase then interacts with the cyclical weather patterns and exacerbates them, makes them sort of exponentially, or perhaps not literally exponentially, but significantly worse?
That's part of it. And I think that's a very important thing for everyone to just bear in mind. You know, the baseline temperature increase, it's a bit like that whole analogy of putting a frog in a pot and then in cold water and then gradually turning up the heat. And you don't realize you're in trouble until it's too late. And that's exactly what's happened. We've been gradually turning up the heat. Humans are extremely adaptable, and so we've adapted collectively and individually in various ways, some of them quite damaging to the continuation of the warming. And so we're now in the situation where the baseline temperature is in some parts of the world 2 degrees or more above what it was 50 years ago.
That's a really important point to make, isn't it? Because we often think about it when we call it global heating or climate change or whatever, we tend to think about it in uniform terms.
Yeah.
And we talk about the global temperature rise in you know, decimal points.
Yes.
And this to lay ears is perhaps doesn't sound all that severe. But it's not uniform, that's what you're saying.
No, it's not uniform. So there are parts of southeastern Australia, as an example, where the temperature trend, as defined by the Bureau of Meteorology data, has been 0.2 to 0.3 of a degree per decade for the last 40 years. And if you add that up, you very quickly get to more than 1 degree. And if you talk about going back to the beginning of the record, which is in 1910, it's already exceeded 2 degrees higher than it was then. So that is highly significant. Even 2 degrees doesn't sound like a lot. You know, if you're cold in winter, like we are here in Canberra at the minute, and you turn up your thermostat by 2 degrees, you can go from being just uncomfortable to perhaps slightly uncomfortable in a too hot way, too cold to slightly too warm at a 2 degree temperature difference. That's possible. But it doesn't sound like a lot. But what it is enough to cause the extremes of weather, the extremes of temperature to become more so. So we've not only seen an increase in the frequency of extreme events, so extremely hot weather, extremely cold weather, droughts, floods, etc., they're getting more frequent, more common, but the intensity of them has increased. And that is happening around this warming trend.
So intensity and frequency, which actually leads me to, I suppose this is one of the questions that's been in my mind about this is, you know, when we're going back to the discussion about what we know from the models, from the evidence, what we can predict, where we are at the present. Is there any view within the scientific community, your expert community on this, about the risk of sort of unforeseen consequences, that is, of a certain tipping point where weather patterns, perhaps the direction of the Gulf Stream changes further, or currents that exist at the moment literally take an entirely different path as a result of, and then there being some level of chaos?
This is an excellent question. Thank you very much. The whole concept of tipping points is one that is very much of concern to us. And it's one that has received quite a deal of scientific attention. The problem with tipping points, so first of all, perhaps I should explain. A way that resonates with a lot of people. Imagine that you've got one of those, thin, clear plastic rulers, and it's a 30-centimeter ruler. You're holding it in both hands in front of you, and you just flex it slightly. I think we can all imagine that. You can flex it a bit, and you know, it's fine. It bends a bit, and that's okay. And then if you just keep going, not conscious of flexing any harder, it suddenly snaps.
Yeah. Keep your face away from it because it may snap twice in two places. Yeah.
Exactly. And that is a tipping point.
Mm.
So natural systems are flexible. They are buffered by the processes that go on within them, and they can deal with quite an amount of change in many instances. But you can only push them so far, and you don't always recognize when you've pushed them too far. And this is why species go extinct, for example. They've been pushed too far and we didn't know until it was too late, right? So tipping points in the climate system are many. And one of the things about them that I think is particularly pertinent is that they are all connected to each other. This is all part of a global system, which involves the atmosphere, the ocean, the earth, the solid, you know, the soil, the vegetation, and it involves the ice. So Antarctic summer sea ice, or in fact, Antarctic winter sea ice, is at an all-time low for the period of records that we have. And in fact, the glaciological community doesn't know why exactly. So the Antarctic ice for the first, not the, exactly the first time, but certainly to the greatest extent is showing signs of being under great stress. We've had record temperatures recorded, winter temperatures recorded in Antarctica, 8 degrees above average over parts of the land. In the Arctic.
Eight degrees.
Above average, yes. I mean, still very cold, but it's, yeah, but eight it's degrees very above significant average. Change. Yeah. Hugely significant.
8 degrees, yeah.
The Arctic, the summer sea ice, has been thinning and shrinking over the years, going up and down a bit from year to year, but the trend is very clearly downwards.
And these caps are highly reflective of radiant.
Exactly. What happens, you've got highly reflective white snow-covered surfaces, reflects away the sunlight, stays cool. You melt a bit, you expose a darker ocean, that absorbs more energy from the sun, it warms up a bit, that warm water goes under the ice, melts it from underneath, which is something that we didn't initially realize what was happening, but of course is, and that melts a bit more ice, and the air temperature around the ice rises.
Sort of a cascading effect.
And you get what's called a positive feedback loop.
Yeah.
There is now a growing thinking, I wouldn't call it a consensus yet, but it is growing, that we may have passed the tipping point threshold for the Arctic summer sea ice. Now, what does that mean when you pass the threshold? Well, it means that natural processes are not going to bring it back. It isn't all gone yet, but natural processes will not be able to regrow that ice to any extent such as it had before, and eventually it will not be there in the summer. And potentially, eventually, it will not be there in the winter either. Now, the Arctic sea ice is not actually a problem for us in terms of sea level rise because it's floating in the ocean and it's like ice cubes in a glass. They displace their volume, and when it melts, it doesn't actually change the level in the glass appreciably at all. So that's not a problem. But the Greenland ice cap and the glaciers on the North American and Eurasian continents are also melting. And that's putting water into the oceans. And they're on land.
Yeah.
So that is raising sea levels.
Yeah.
And we're seeing sea level rising everywhere due to thermal expansion. As it warms it, the volume expands.
Yeah.
So there's that going on, but there's also this contribution from the ice, which has now overtaken the warming as the major contributor to rising sea levels. And the projections now for sea level rise are that we're looking at over a meter by the end of the century and possibly sooner. And that's big. You know, there's been some modeling done for Australia where they've done a sort of GIS, geographic information system based mapping of the elevation of the land around the coastline. And they've looked at particularly the populated areas where of course, most of our major cities are on the coast. And it's shown, for example, that a fair proportion of the Brisbane CBD and the location of Brisbane Airport with new runways and so on would be underwater. So
finally, when it starts affecting, you know, urban centres with political clout and commercial implications, big investments involved and so forth, big assets.
Unfortunately, by then it's too late because you're locked in for another 30 years of it getting worse before you have a hope of seeing a real impact. What we are seeing, I think, and why we're seeing the Northern Hemisphere doing what it's doing right now is that there is this, what we call the sensitivity of the climate to the disruptions that are being pushed on it. And I think I wouldn't say a lack of understanding. We know that it's sensitive, but what we don't fully understand is how sensitive and which little prod or jerk in a particular direction is going to cause a tipping point threshold to be to be crossed. And the thing with the tipping points, yeah, I've just been talking about the ice, but you know, the whole general long-term circulation of the global ocean, it's called the global ocean conveyor system, which involves large masses of water sinking down from the surface to the deep ocean and then traveling and then coming up again and so on. And this connects all the global oceans together. Now, the main drivers for that water going down from the surface to the bottom is around the margins of the Arctic ice, and so in the Northern Hemisphere, in the North Atlantic, and along the coast of Antarctica. Now, both of those areas are showing signs of real retreat. Strain yeah. and retreat. Mm. And as the ice retreats, fresh water is added to the ocean. That reduces the density of the ocean water. The density relies on being cold and saline.
Saline, yeah.
So that means that the rate of water sinking decreases. And you could eventually, in some parts of the ocean, end up with a sort of stratification where you no longer get water sinking in this way or rising in the same way.
Yeah, and that
way.
Goes back to that point
and
about
And there's that whole point
kinds,
you were
yeah,
making.
Yeah.
And the global ocean conveyor plays a role in things like the Southeast and South Asian monsoons systems, which are sort of overlaid onto that.
We've just been messing with all of this without understanding
absolutely.
It for centuries.
Absolutely.
Of course, industrialization has just absolutely kind of telescoped that, really yes. fast-tracked it. Then we've overlaid it with politics and economics and self-interest and human
yes.
delusion, frankly. You know,
yes.
that,
oh,
that capacity we have
yes.
to delay things, you
yes.
know, to not look at problems that we don't have to look at straight away because they're down the track.
And I think there's a capacity in humanity to be hopeful in all sorts of different ways. And we pin
yeah.
our hopes on different things.
We pin our hopes on science whilst actually ignoring it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. And I think in this instance, there's been quite a lot of pinning our hopes on technological solutions that are going to buy us out of trouble.
Hmm.
And there's
cost-free technological solutions.
I'm sorry, I missed that, Maria.
I was being sarcastic.
She said cost-free technological.
Oh, absolutely yeah. cost-free, absolutely. Yeah. We can pump sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere in sufficient volume, which would require actually permanent locations on the Earth's surface with permanent connections to the stratosphere that would do this pumping to keep enough up there to provide a shield that would reflect away the sun's radiation and cool the surface. No. Technologically not, and in fact cost-effectively absolutely not.
That would be quite a structure.
Mirrors in space, you know, to reflect away the sunlight.
Yes,
well,
yes.
Technologically maybe we could.
A lot of these ideas come from the mad right, of people who spent most of the time denying it's a problem in the first place. Yes, interesting. Look, this has been an absolutely fascinating and long overdue discussion, really. I've learnt so much. I'm sure you have, Maria.
Oh, it's been an absolute education.
Yeah, really amazing. And I'm so glad that we've done it now, and we'll have to have you back and talk more about these problems, because there's so much more, I think, so many
yes.
of these issues we can go into further.
Really isn't. I'd love to come back.
Including the capacity for individuals to make difference,
oh, yes.
you know, which I think has taken a long time to land in some yeah. ways. You know, we all tended to think that, you know, this was a bigger problem and individual decisions didn't matter, but people are taking things increasingly into their own hands, you know, with solar PV and
yes.
decisions about recycling and a range of other things. Arguably, people are ahead of their governments now in
yeah.
all kinds of places all around the world. Mm. And, yeah, so politics needs to, as a discipline, needs to pull its socks up, and we can talk about that some more as well.
Absolutely.
Professor Jeanette Lindsay and Dr. Maria Tafalaga, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeanette.
Real pleasure.
Yeah, it's been terrific. But just before I go, I'm going to just make another announcement. You may have heard me refer to the Voice to Parliament dialogue that is happening at ANU. This is really an announcement for people in the Canberra region, and indeed for people listening to this podcast rather quickly after it comes out, because I'm talking about Wednesday, August the 2nd. But if you want to learn more about the Voice to Parliament, ANU is hosting a special dialogue in Canberra on Wednesday, the 2nd of August. I'll be hosting the discussion and we'll be joined by Professor Megan Davis, co-chair of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, Labor Senator Jana Stewart, and Liberal Senator Andrew Bragg, among some others. And it promises to be a really dynamic and interesting session. And it will deal with some of the questions that are coming up that people are raising in social media and in other places. Really quite basic questions as well as some more involved ones. No question is out of order, and I think it'll be a really useful exercise in explaining what is proposed here for this referendum and helping people come to a conclusion about where they stand on it. So if you're interested in taking part, you can find more details via the link in this episode description. That is Democracy Sausage for this week. Talk again soon.
Bye.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.